And I'm fucking livid that we are stuck in the timeline where Alex Jones is right.
Oh no!
Why aren't the Amish afraid of COVID? Because they don't have TVs.
As I said, democracy is a system that reinforces authoritarian ideals.
Hope I don't get canceled. Talk to Steve.
Being a victim of a tragedy doesn't make you an expert in public policy.
Well, I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
Remember, they lost the Afghan war 10 years ago.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
They said, you don't get to tell us no. We're in the state health department. And I said, hell no.
It wasn't making Christianity better. It was making rock worse.
What the fuck do you have on your face, Olivia?
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Remember thinking, man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists and people of the internet, thank you for tuning into another episode of O'Donnell for Liberty. As always, I'm your host, Justin. And before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you listen on, whether YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on the air at LRN.FM, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and sharing with your friends. If you enjoy the content, you can join our production team by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell for Liberty. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell, the number four, Liberty. And make sure to check out sneckswag.com for all your favorite Liberty merch, including some brand new designs for t-shirts, hoodies, stickers, coffee mugs, tote bags, and much, much more. You can check out the awesome collection of hoodies that are just in time for colder weather this winter. So make sure you head on over to sneckswag.com to get your Liberty merch today. And if you want to keep in touch between shows, follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans of the show at any time. All these links can be found in the description of the video or podcast you're listening to, as well as over on O'Donnell4Liberty.com. So check that description for the link and make sure you check it out today. Now, recently in the news, Cato Institute has published their Freedom in the 50 States report, and once again, we saw New Hampshire claim the top spot as the freest state in the nation, and a lot of the reasons for this, as discussed on the last show we did, was because of the success of the Free State Project and its participants. And tonight, we're joined to talk about this and discuss, really at a higher level, the Free State Project founder, as well as the author of Cato's Freedom Index, Dr. Jason Sorens. Jason, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Justin.
So you founded the Free State Project, and it has spiraled kind of into a force of its own that has its haters, its lovers, its successes, and some failures. But how much credit do you give to the Free State Project off the bat for New Hampshire being the freest state in the country?
A lot of credit. You look at New Hampshire's trajectory before the Free State Project came, it wasn't great on freedom. We have data going back to 2000, and through the 2000s, up through 2010, New Hampshire was declining on freedom and actually declining faster than other states. Most states were actually declining on freedom during that period. And since then, New Hampshire has increased on freedom, and it's increased faster than most other states, and it's reclaimed that number one spot. So New Hampshire has been making reforms, and I think a big part of that has to do with the Free State Project. You can see it in election results, too. In my view, you can see New Hampshire becoming more of a blue state up until 2004. And then after 2004, it tilts a little bit red again, and then it just stayed right there as a just about the most evenly divided state in the country between Republican and Democrat.
Well, I like to joke that it's the swingiest of swing states. I mean, we reelected a Republican governor in an overwhelming landslide, and the exact same landslide reelected a Democratic congressional delegation.
Yeah, you know, I think New Hampshire voters are pretty smart, and you know, they will vote based on the policy environment and the economic environment of the day. And so there were a lot of Trump skeptics in New Hampshire, a lot of suburban Republicans went Democratic in federal races, but went Republican in state races. They were making that distinction, splitting their ticket. We don't see that in most of the country now. You see, straight ticket voting just about everywhere, but New Hampshire is an exception. I think that's good. It indicates that voters are a little more independent, willing to think for themselves.
Now, the decision of the Free State Project to choose New Hampshire to for the migration and to settle everyone. That wasn't even your decision. I mean, I'm sure you had a part in lobbying and pushing, campaigning for what you wanted, but it was really just the idea that was yours from the start. What possessed you, and like, what was your thought process, and what possessed you to sit down and like say, you know what, this is the path forward. We need to get everyone in one spot. It's not working anymore.
Yeah. Well, actually, just to set the record straight, I did stay neutral during the state the selection process. All right. but privately, I did end up voting for New Hampshire for selfish reasons. Number one, because it was it had the most colleges and universities where I might get a job. So that,
that determined
my vote. But yeah, what made me think of this idea of finding a state where we could concentrate the forces of liberty and create a free society? Mm-hmm. Well, it came out of disillusionment after the 2000 election. I'd been active in the Libertarian Party in 96, 98, the midterm, and 2000. And I was really disappointed that libertarians had lost their momentum that they had gained in the 90s. The 90s were the original libertarian moment in a way. You know, you had globalization, the internet. In those days, in the days of the early internet, it was heavily libertarian. You know, and Harry Brown was winning all the web polls and things like that on the early web. You know, we had novels like Cryptonomicon coming out that suggested that maybe global capital and cryptography and the internet could be liberating technologies that would make government obsolete. But that didn't turn out to be the case. It turned out that the tide of public opinion swung back. You could already see it with George W. Bush. The Republican Party was moving in a direction that was not libertarian. Needless to say, the Democratic Party with Al Gore wasn't either. There just didn't seem to be a way for libertarians to take over the federal government. There still doesn't. I don't think that's ever going to happen. And so if we were going to have a free society, we needed to create it somewhere else. And the most logical place to do it is in a single state, because we are still a federal system. There's a lot that states can do if they want to gain autonomy and create more liberty for their citizens. And, you know, just because states haven't done it so far doesn't mean that they can't. And so we decided we're going to, I published an essay in this online journal called The Libertarian Enterprise. It was L. Neil Smith's webzine. Back in the day, and I think it's still active. And 200 people emailed me saying that they wanted to put this together. So we did that, and the rest is history.
Now, you say you were active in the Libertarian Party. I was very active in the Libertarian Party. I still am very active in the Libertarian Party. And I didn't move to New Hampshire as a signer or a mover for the Free State Project. I actually moved for work and ended up finding my neighbors who I agreed with, who were like, hey, come hang out at the Quill, meet these Free Staters. Next thing I know, I'm running the YouTube channel and the social media for the Free State Project. And everything just cascaded really quickly. Yeah. But I was very critical of the Free State Project when I was on the board of the Libertarian Party and very mm-hmm. active with the Libertarian Party in Massachusetts, because I always thought they had kind of missed an opportunity by moving so many ardent libertarians to a single state and trying to make a case of a third party in that state, because at the time, and I've evolved on this issue a little bit, and based on my experience working in politics, I thought one of the bigger problems that we were facing was the legitimacy of the two-party system, with the Republicans mm-hmm. and Democrats being corporate parties that were completely top-down controlled, that no matter how much you fixed your local party, it was by running as a Republican and working with inside the system, you were endorsing the system as it existed and not actually bringing the message of true liberty to your constituents. And I had thought at the time, and I was very strong of the opinion, that the Free State Project should have focused on the community level, not necessarily the organizational level, of starting its own party, running as libertarians, winning as libertarians in New Hampshire, and really taking over the state in a way that set it apart from the liberty movement in the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was a great opportunity for a proof of concept with that. If you're moving so many libertarians to New Hampshire, that would benefit the Libertarian Party image, the liberty movement's image, and overall benefit New Hampshire. And I got really upset when I got here and all the libertarians were Republicans. I know part of your essay was like due to the failures of the Libertarian Party, but did it ever cross your mind that maybe this would be a way to revive the Libertarian Party, or were you always, who cares, just get in office?
I thought that could happen, that some of the success could happen through the Libertarian Party. There was no in principle reason to favor working with one of the major parties or with the Libertarian Party. For me, it was whatever works, whatever gets us there, you know, whatever gets us the right people elected, whatever gets us the right policies in place, ultimately, that's what matters. And it'd be awesome to have a multi-party system. I think voters should have more choices. And I think the Libertarian Party has uses, even if it's not electing people. It can be a great tool for punishing bad incumbent politicians, right? I mean, if especially bad Republicans, because I think, you know, in the New Hampshire context, the LP probably draws a little more from Republican voters, at least my crunching of the data suggests that's the case. And so you can threaten to run a Libertarian candidate if the Republican incumbent is being an authoritarian. And you know, that can be a good mechanism for causing these politicians to change their minds on some important issues, because
I'm not sure that was always the case, that libertarians drew more from Republicans than Democrats. I think maybe at a period of history it kind of transitioned to that, but for a long time it was kind of right down the middle.
Yeah.
And because I look at the electoral history of New Hampshire, and I look at New Hampshire, of the three states that had ever elected partisan libertarians to their state legislature, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Alaska before 2000, Alaska and Vermont had each elected one, and New Hampshire had elected like a dozen or so. It was not uncommon for libertarians to just outright win legislative seats in New Hampshire until the start of the Free State Project, really. And like early movers started coming, and I don't think it's so much that the early movers shifted things right so much as the Democrats and the progressives and Granite State Progress and these other organizations took mm-hmm. such an affront to the idea of the Free State Project that they started campaigning actively against the Free State Project and pointing out that it was just Republican infiltration, and that kind of set the narrative in New Hampshire of that's where we were.
Yeah, I mean, the first free stater to get elected to the state house was a Democrat, Joel Winters, and we've had others who've been elected, but the Democratic Party tried to reject them. They activated their immune system, and they would outright campaign against their incumbents, who were libertarian-minded Democrats, in primaries to try to get them out, and so we got the message, and you know, as a result. Yeah, the Democratic Party in New Hampshire just doesn't have conservatives and moderates. It's a liberal party, and that's not the case with state Democratic parties elsewhere. But that's the case in New Hampshire, and so you're not, you know, the Republican Party in New Hampshire is the diverse party. It's got moderates, conservatives, religious right, libertarians, you know, Trump nationalist types. It's got the whole gamut, and so the Republican Party is sort of like is more like Will Rogers' aphorism that I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Now he would say Republican, because the Republicans are the sort of grassroots disorganized party, and the Democrats are the sort of centralized, top down, lockstep. You know, much more ideological and homogeneous party.
And I feel like, as somebody who's campaigned in New Hampshire, who's done door knocking in New Hampshire, who's done outreach events and like talked to my neighbors in the community around me, I feel like the party is disconnected from the voters, because I feel like the New Hampshire voters who are aligned with the Democratic Party are really diverse, and there's a lot of moderates and Democrats. I used to joke that a New Hampshire Democrat was just a Massachusetts Republican in disguise, but like, because there is such a diversity there, but the party itself as an apparatus, as an organization, really has been become a monolithic top down. You do what you're told or you're out. And I remember one of the things that had spurned Joseph Stalkopp, who was a Democrat state rep, to leave the Democratic Party and join the Libertarian Party, was that after his experience out in Standing Rock, he went to go join the protests with the water protectors out in Standing Rock. He came back and gave a talk on the House floor. He's like, listen, I can't vote for gun control anymore because I've seen the consequences of gun control firsthand when people weren't able to defend themselves against state agents and state police. And he supported a gun rights bill in the House, and he was removed from every committee that he was on. They put up a recruitment to try and primary him. He's like, fine, I'm out. I'm joining the Libertarian Party.
Wow. I didn't know that story. That's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, leadership is aggressive, and you do get a lot of these sort of tactical or reluctant Democrats in New Hampshire who say, well, you know, Democrats are too far left, but, you know, I can't support Trump or something like that. And or they may have a single issue like abortion or something that causes them to kind of hold their nose and pull the lever for Democrats. And you get a lot of Republicans who are exactly the same way,
right?
Reversed. So yeah, you have the opportunity to reach out to those voters. So, you know, long story short, I think, it'd be great if we had some electoral system reform that would make it possible for libertarians to actually win. And I think if you had that, like proportional representation or approval voting, if you had that, a lot of voters would actually be willing to vote libertarian. But now you get the whole wasted vote problem.
I've been a massive critic of ranked choice voting in New Hampshire. Yeah. And I've actually gone to testify against the ranked choice voting bills, and I've had other libertarians scream at me. It's like, that's awful. I'm like, I don't know. If I actually look at the history of ranked choice voting and look at the math of ranked choice voting, it's historically hurt third-party candidates. It's historically relegated them to permanent irrelevancy. and there's reasons why places that have had it have ended up repealing it. Like Burlington, Vermont had it, and they ended up repealing it because it got one of the least popular candidates elected after like 18 rounds of runoffs.
You're right. Yeah, I mean, ranked choice voting eliminates the blackmail party that third party power that third parties can have, right? So you can't any longer run against an authoritarian Republican to kind of toss the election to a Democrat as a libertarian, because with ranked choice voting, all those votes for you are just going to get redistributed potentially to that Republican. So it actually makes you irrelevant, as you said. So I'm not a fan of ranked choice voting. I think it's there are lots of problems with it. I think it's just sort of a dead end. You know, it takes us in the wrong direction. You know, and one of the most interesting things we could do is we've got this Senate of 24 senators in New Hampshire. Their districts make no sense, right? Their districts are all gerrymandered and spread out all over the state. There's no geographic principle of representation there. Just make the whole state an electoral district, let people vote for a party and allocate seats proportionally to votes. And you can very easily get a libertarian elected then.
I think even if you left the Senate as is, as more of a representative, but made it kind of a split thing with the House, I think people are so accustomed to having such a large body with the House of Representatives in New Hampshire, 400 state reps, that proportional representation might be something you could actually sell.
Yeah, that's true. The House, you have... You know, towns are jealous of their representatives. So you cannot do the whole state as an electoral district for the House. People would absolutely rebel against that. They want to have, you know, their town representatives. But what you could do is allocate proportionally within each town, because some towns do have multiple representatives. So that would definitely be an option.
You look at Hudson and Pelham, they have 11 between the two of them.
Yeah.
And it's absurd, because like that was one of the problems I pointed out with ranked choice voting in the last bill that went to the House. I I went down there. I'm like, you want to, there's three parties on the ballot now, and you want to put ranked choice voting in Hudson and Bellum. That means ranking 33 potential candidates plus write-ins. The number of possible computations of orders is actually greater than the number of voters in New Hampshire. And you'd have to run a test ballot for every order.
Yeah, that, it's a nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah,
there are all sorts of problems with it. Like you can't count the votes by precinct. You actually have to send all the votes to a central location.
Right.
Yeah.
So and that's why Maine instituted ranked choice voting, and everyone thought it was going to go great, and then we didn't know who won the election for a week.
Right.
Where everyone is, and I believe New Hampshire actually requires reporting the night of.
Yeah.
So it'd be impossible. Plus, there's still towns in New Hampshire that have like a grandfather clause through the state constitution that say all their ballots are cast on paper and hand counted because they only have 11 voters in the town. But like, how do you then plug that in?
Yeah. Now, you know, the other thing is if you're going to let voters rank options, why not just pick the majority winner? So we did this to choose our state for the Free State Project. We let everyone rank all 10 states that were under consideration. And we chose the state that beat every other state by a majority, you know, head to head, because you can calculate that from the rankings. Yep. And that was New Hampshire.
That's the only thing I actually love about ranked choice voting is like with a ranked choice ballot, the amount of data you actually get, because you can count a ranked choice ballot in 100 different ways. And the kind of data you get is completely different, no matter depending on which way you count it. And I'm part of an organization. We use ranked choice voting to select our board every year. I've argued that it works here because we have a highly intelligent voting population that understands the voting system, and that's why it works. But like, I always, as a hobby, at the end of every election, I take all the ballots and recount them under different methods, and we get different results.
Yeah, that's
like interesting. Like through Scottish STV and Cambridge STV, we get completely different election results with the same ballots. So if the people voting don't understand the implications of how their vote is going to be counted, then you're really throwing stuff at the wall.
Yeah. You don't want to mess with people's faith in the electoral system if you don't have to. You know, you want the votes to be counted fairly in a way that's transparent, that everyone can say, okay, there's no fraud here, there's no trickery. I can trust the outcome.
Well, and that's one of the things I think New Hampshire voters in particular, because New Hampshire is one of the most political states I've ever lived in. You can't get every 4 years, you cannot get a breakfast in Manchester without running into a presidential candidate. Everybody in the state has met somebody running for president at some point in the last decade, whether intentionally or just walking down the street, bumping into them, because everyone comes here and everyone is aware of politics to at least a little degree. And people don't like change at all. So messing with that. And I know there was a bill last year to change just even the Democratic primary to ranked choice voting, and that got crushed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think the Democratic Party should be able to do whatever the hell they want for their primary. It shouldn't have anything to do with the state. But even that got crushed.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think we need to go back to seeing political parties as private clubs. That's what they are. And they can set their own rules for how they select their candidates. I have a big problem with state government dictating parties' internal procedures, because this is a problem for the Libertarian Party. You can get candidates like a few years ago, this guy Tom Alsier, who's just a nutcase, filed as a Libertarian.
I primaried him.
Yeah. The party should be able to take people like that off the ballot. That should be a matter of freedom of association right there.
And in fact, that was the first time I ever ran for office, and it wasn't something I wanted to do. It's something I got pressured into doing because somebody freaked out, like, Tom Alsier is running for Congress. And I'm like, well, that sucks. They're like, who's going to run against him? I'm like, damn it. I guess it's me. I ended up winning the primary with 80% of the vote. When I did look at it, when I went town by town to look at the results, he didn't get a single vote in a single town where he wasn't listed first on the ballot. So I think that might, so there's even low information libertarian voters out there, I think.
I guess so. Wow.
But beyond that, so the Free State Project's had the success. We've given up on using the Libertarian Party as the only means and the only avenue to approach liberty. And now Jason Osborne, a known and out Free Stater, is the Republican majority leader in the House of Representatives. And we've seen the success in New Hampshire's number one again. What was it? So before we get into why New Hampshire's number one again, what was it, in your opinion, as the author of this index, that knocked New Hampshire to number two last time?
Yeah. It was more that Florida had just leapfrogged New Hampshire last time. So New Hampshire was not doing well, given the data we had at the time, was not doing well on land use regulation.
We're still not.
So zoning restrictions were going up and up in the state, you know, a local issue. And that was not the case in Florida. And Florida had been making some reforms, especially tax cuts, things like that, medical marijuana. Florida actually does okay on personal freedom. Not as well as New Hampshire, but
not as bad as Texas.
Yeah, not as bad as Texas. It's quite a bit better than Texas. and it's you know, of course it has no income tax, no corporate income tax, which New Hampshire does have. So those were factors that really really helped Florida. But again, it was so close last time. And again, you know, I'm not fudging the data because I could have just changed one tiny variable. No one would ever have noticed to make New Hampshire number one last time, but I didn't. And this time again, it was pretty close. So Florida's number two, but it's still close. And Florida has actually improved a little bit since last time. So it's more New Hampshire leapfrogging Florida, just because of what we've done.
And it's not even like New Hampshire ranked super high in every category. I went over the whole report category by category with Jeff and Melissa Cream of the New Hampshire Liberty Alliance on Monday night. And they're sitting there taking notes like, oh, crap, we're 45th. We need to fix that.
Yeah.
Like New Hampshire is down near the bottom in some of these categories.
Yeah. Land use freedom is still a problem, although we register some improvement there, a little bit of improvement. You know, the state government is starting to get involved to preempt some of the exclusionary zoning that's going on in the state, which I think is a good thing. But yeah, labor market freedom could be a little better. Occupational freedom could be a little better. Obviously marijuana is kind of middle of the pack, maybe a little bit better than middle of the pack, but we don't have recreational yet. So there are definitely some things that New Hampshire could improve, but really the reason New Hampshire ends up number one is that New Hampshire's near the top in so many categories. Even if it's not at the top, like it's not the lowest tax state in the country, but it's number two. And, it's not number one in personal freedom. Nevada is, but it's up there. It's in the top five. So you put all that together, it's really the only state that can lay claim to being really, really high on lots of economic and personal freedom categories.
Now, what do you think was the bit? Now, again, the data cuts off New Year's 2019, so not including 2020 or 2021, which have arguably been some of the best years for liberty legislation ever in New Hampshire.
Right.
What was it that made the biggest jump to you guys for New Hampshire as far as improvements?
Yeah. So we didn't get the educational freedom accounts in there, but we did get the Croydon bill, which allows local option essentially a local option voucher program, if you will, school choice. So if you don't have public school in certain grades, you can now as a town allow parents to send their kids to private schools, and the town will pay that tuition up to the per capita level that they would have given otherwise to the public school. And so far, I think only Croydon takes advantage of that, and a few other Vermont border towns, and maybe some Maine border towns for high school only. But that was a significant jump. I mean, and I would expect more towns to start to take advantage of that in the future. So that's a big increase in school choice and educational freedom. We also saw the certificate of need law go away. That happened in 2016, but that's pretty significant. We saw some significant tax cuts. So New Hampshire's been pretty consistently cutting taxes over the last 5 or 6 years. I mentioned the state starting to do some stuff about excessive zoning, including the Housing Appeals Board and workforce housing law, and also a law requiring towns to allow accessory dwelling units or in-law apartments. Mm-hmm. So one of only a handful of states actually now that allows that statewide. So that's really quite a nice achievement. We also saw marijuana decriminalization. We saw medical marijuana legalization, and that's been gradually expanded. And we have a pretty sensitive measure of that captures some of those expansions in that law. We had, I think this might have been 2016, but we definitely had Dan McGuire's civil asset forfeiture reform bill, now criminal conviction required for civil asset forfeiture. So those are some really big changes that have happened in New Hampshire over the last 5 years or so and account for its increase.
Civil asset forfeiture is a big one in the news this week, at least.
Yeah.
After $100,000, didn't even detain her, no arrest, just took her luggage. It's mind-blowing how they can get away with that. And I still don't know, like, under what guise they even can defend it. The police department that took her money posted a picture with the dog celebrating that they took it.
I know. Like, have they no self-awareness? People are horrified by this kind of stuff. You know, I was on Twitter, some guy responded to the announcement of the study. And he's a New Yorker, saying something like, "Name me one thing that I can do in New Hampshire that you can do in New Hampshire that I can't in New York." And he got ratioed. It was a long, long list of things. But one of them was that I posted was, not get my life savings stolen by cops and then have to try to go to court to get it back. And he's like, "That doesn't happen."
Link.
So I educated him a little bit on that. And he was like, "Okay, wow." Did not know about that.
So the land usage one is a big issue of mine. It's a big issue I've been trying to get people to take more seriously in New Hampshire, free staters and non-free staters alike. Because we see this, I drive downtown Manchester and it just seems like the homeless population is growing by the day. But the Free State Project keeps talking about bringing people here. And one of the biggest complaints I get through the YouTube and the social media that I help manage for the Free State Project is the cost of housing and how expensive it is to live here. And I'm seeing people pushed out of New Hampshire, younger people being pushed out every day because they can't afford to both work and live here because the zoning is so restrictive, how there is no new housing being built, any of that. And I think that's something that's gaining wind across party lines, across just the Liberty movement and through the general population as well. And I remember a couple years ago, Andrew Olding, he was running for Congress as a Libertarian, and he was going out of his way to go to all the local Democrat meetups in the Nashua area. And he managed to get, explaining how zoning laws restrict new construction, how we didn't have affordable housing because it took so long and it was so expensive to build everything. And he got somebody in a Democrat meeting to say, "Oh, why don't we just abolish zoning laws?" And then they all clicked and said, no, don't do that. But they're on the way. They're getting it. They're figuring it out on their own.
Yeah. I mean, this is part of what I do in my day job for the Center for Ethics at St. Anselm College. We have a Housing We Need initiative, and we're looking at ways to solve the housing shortage, including regulatory reform. That's a big part of it. And one of our advisors, who shall remain nameless, but is not a libertarian, probably left of center, but a major nonprofit housing developer in the state. He said, "You want to know my solution to the housing shortage? Get rid of local zoning."
I feel like that's so simple an answer that it's beyond the ability of your normal person to understand.
Right.
Like everyone is expecting policy to be so complex and nuanced that they cannot grasp the idea of just repealing something, making everything better.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not going to happen in a lot of places, but we still have places in New Hampshire that don't have zoning. We can stop it from coming in, and we can just go into these zoning ordinances and piece by piece take things out or just, relax these regulations. What we need is more of this so-called by right development, where we're just going to say this type of thing you can just build, and you don't have to go and beg for 10 permits from the planning board and the zoning board and all these variances and special exceptions and things like that. We're not going to do that. We're just going to say you can build this wide range of types of housing in our town.
Well, I look at it. There's a building on my street that's pretty decrepit and run down, and to renovate it, it's been on the market forever. And I looked at it with a group of people to think about investing and buying it, building it back up and renting it out for an investment property. And like the cost of renovation, because everything was so old and decrepit, would be in the $200,000 range. The cost of tearing it down and building a brand new building would be in the $200,000 range.
Right.
So it's like, but then look at the local zoning laws. And because zoning laws have gotten so restrictive in Manchester since that building was built, we wouldn't be able to build the same building on its footprint because it doesn't have 6 off-street parking spaces. It doesn't have enough clearance between the neighbors' lots to build up to the property line. And like you can't even improve upon the property that you have here in Manchester because the zoning is so restrictive.
Yeah. Drew Klein at the Josiah Bartlett Center, the free market think tank in New Hampshire, says most of the best neighborhoods in the state would be illegal to build today. Right. They're grandfathered in, but you couldn't recreate them anywhere. They would just be illegal. The lot sizes are too small. There's not enough parking. There's not enough setbacks from the road. People like that. People don't want big roads, huge lots.
Some people do. The people that do want to live out in Croydon or want to live up in the North Country. The younger people who want to work in tech want a walkable downtown in a walkable city where they don't need to own a car. And to do that, you got to have small lots and taller buildings with more units.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what the market would give you. You know, they'd give us that range to meet customer demand if it were allowed to operate.
Yeah. Now, one of the categories you ranked in New Hampshire, I've seen a lot of people very upset that New Hampshire wasn't number one on the ranking, and that's firearms freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Given all the work that Free Staters have done in the past decade regarding firearms freedom, how in the world is Kansas better than New Hampshire on guns?
All right, you're getting into a deep dive here, and I did look at this, but I'm gonna answer this for you because, as I recall, it is one single policy out of something like 30 different gun laws that we code where New Hampshire is not quite as good as Kansas. And I'm gonna find this for you. And it's gonna be something pretty trivial and obscure because there's not a big difference actually between Kansas and New Hampshire. And I've got the file open now. They're so close, one and two, but there's just one little thing where they're different.
If you say snowmobiles, I'm going to be so upset.
No, it's licensing of gun dealers. Apparently, New Hampshire has state-level licensing of gun dealers. That is the one difference. Otherwise, we have, according to every policy we have the most sort of free policy on every gun measure we track, which is almost, I said 30, it's actually closer to 50 variables that we have.
Licensing on dealers. I didn't even know we had that in New Hampshire. And I'm pretty sure I had an argument with somebody who was talking about trying to maybe do some little agorist gun sales, and they were insisting it was perfectly legal and they didn't need a license and it wouldn't attract bad attention to us.
Well, I think it's if you, you know, it's probably not all gun sales that you need a license for, but there's probably if it's a sort of routine type of thing and you get a federal firearms license, you probably need some sort of state level registration or something. And that's my guess. But I haven't looked into that in detail.
No, I was expecting Vermont to be higher on that ranking, and then I realized, well, Vermont had no gun laws for, like, ever in the past 2 years. They actually have started passing gun laws out of the blue.
That's right.
So
Vermont's gone down.
So I used to hold Vermont up as the standard when I lived in Western Mass. It's like I remember seeing people because I lived up near the border for a little bit, and people would just show up at Walmart open carrying all the time, and some like a cop would ask, "Do you have a license for that?" And I watched a guy ask a cop, "What's a license?" And the cop was like, "Just go back to Vermont." people that just didn't know that gun licenses were a thing.
Right. They never had them. Yeah.
Right. And now they've got licenses and magazine restrictions and assault weapons bans, and it's crazy. So
yeah, Vermont, I think, is going down the, you know, it was a liberal state for a long time, and now finally that's feeding into their gun laws.
Now, have you heard of the Progressive State Project?
I've seen a couple of their posts on social media. Yes.
So now, how do you feel about the Progressive State Project?
I think it's great. You know, I think progressives are having a devil of a time getting their agenda through DC. You know, the Joe Manchin, you know, is holding things up. So why not, you know, get behind
Vermont.
The, yeah, you take Vermont, take New York. I mean, you already have New York. Just, you know, go and push that cart further down the road, because you know that you're pushing on an open door there. Like, they're already progressive.
I know at one point we started, it started losing its traction, but we were really pissing people off where, like, whenever somebody, the Free State Project would tweet something on Twitter and the progressives would just come out of the woodworks to attack the FSP and attack libertarians, we would always just respond with a picture of the big sign that said Massachusetts welcomes you.
Right.
Like, no words, don't say anything, just respond with that sign, and they'd lose their minds.
So. Yeah. Well, you know, it's all in good fun, right? Massachusetts is not such a bad state on freedom, surprisingly. It's the second best state in New England.
That's a really low bar.
It's a low bar. They're like number 30 in the country, but for being so far left for so long, they really do okay. I think their leadership realizes that if they went crazy, businesses would just pick up and move across the border to New Hampshire. So,
well, I think one of the big things that's helping Massachusetts, maybe in your rankings, is things like cannabis freedom and marriage equality, where they led the nation in those things, mm-hmm. and they were among the first to do them. But that really is just like, I argue with people. I still have this argument with free staters all the time, where I'm like, I feel like we're having such great success at cherry picking the liberties on the right because the Republicans have let us in and let us co-opt the Republican Party so easily that we've had all these successes, but we're not having successes on the left on things that are just as big liberty things, and that's what's holding us back. But whereas Massachusetts, one of the most progressive states in the country, marriage equality was the first in the country, cannabis legalization, they were second in the country to do it, and they've led the way in those things. And I think that's the personal freedom might be the only thing keeping them at near the top of that list in doing
that. Yeah. I mean, New Hampshire was the first state in the country to legalize same-sex marriage through the legislative process. So, so New Hampshire's no slouch on some of these things, but I totally agree with you that we need to get moving on some of the more social lefty freedoms, you know, the marijuana stuff. And again, maybe that's an area where the Libertarian Party can play a constructive role by saying, hey, Republicans, we've been waiting. It's time now. The vast majority of Granite Staters want this.
I don't think it needs to be the Libertarian Party. I look at the makeup of the state legislature right now, and the Free State Project likes to brag all the time that there's 40-plus Free Staters in the state legislature. But the reality is New Hampshire Liberty Alliance ranks everybody on their Libertarian voting record, and there's over 100 state reps that have an A or higher rating because they vote the Libertarian line in the state house. Like, that is enough to get a supermajority if they just vote in block with the Democrats on some of these progressive bills, like marijuana decrim. Yeah. And I think the thing that's held them back has been, like, deconstructive libertarian autism. Like, where the last time we had a marijuana legalization bill in the House, Free Staters killed it by accident because they amended it to take out all the taxes.
Yeah.
And then it has stood no chance of passing the Senate without taxes.
Right. Yeah, let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good. Yeah, my view here is, again, the message to Governor Sununu is, you know, step aside and let this pass into law, or we start running candidates against you and against other statewide Republicans. You know, and maybe that has some effect.
Well, I don't know how much I'm at liberty to just reveal, but I think there's a big announcement about something like that coming out in the next week or so.
Okay.
That might anger some Republicans, but it might even anger a lot of libertarians if it's what I think it is. But, I mean, most of these other states, is like Kurt in the chat is pointing out, New Hampshire passed it in the House and got blocked in the Senate, but every other state's doing it by ballot measure to bypass their legislature altogether. New Hampshire doesn't have ballot measures. We don't have the ability for people to have any direct democracy on anything other than a constitutional amendment that the state house already agreed to.
Yeah.
Do you think that's something that might hold us back, or maybe is holding us back?
I mean, there's a clear relationship between ballot initiative and marijuana legalization. I think Illinois and New York are the only states that have passed it legislatively to this point. And these are really, really deep blue states where they, you know, they, in New York's case, you had an embattled governor trying to pander to the electorate. But I am so glad we do not have the ballot initiative in New Hampshire, because it does a lot of stupid stuff around the country. So, like, you know, and you have states like South Dakota, one of the most conservative states in the country, passing really high minimum wages because of the ballot initiative. Arizona as well.
South Dakota also passed marijuana legalization by a ballot initiative, and then the Freedom Liberty governor used taxpayer money to sue herself to stop it from going into effect.
Yeah, yeah, and the state Supreme Court backed her. So they'll only let the ballot initiatives go into law that the establishment is willing to let go into law, and so that's a bad deal on net for liberty. You get a lot of tax and spending increases through the ballot initiative as well. Florida has had huge problems with that, with people putting education spending in the Constitution, you know, and just there's nothing the legislature can do about that. And it's driving.
I think there could be a middle ground with it. I think the problem you see with these ballot initiatives is that you have states like California, where it's so easy to get any question on the ballot that, like, you'll get two contradicting questions on the ballot in the same given year. And, like, it takes no effort at all to get a question on the ballot, and they'll have a ballot that's 10 pages long full of questions. Florida, where, like, the limit of what you can do with a ballot question is unlimited, so they just amend the Constitution outright. But, like, I look at, like, Massachusetts and Maine, two of the states I'm more familiar with, and I think they have, like, almost a perfect balance. In Maine, it's very difficult to get a question on the ballot that has anything, like, substance to it, but it's very easy to call an election to veto a decision of the legislature or the governor. Right. And that's the only thing, is to repeal something that they did. And then in Massachusetts, it's very difficult to get a question on the ballot. And then if it fails, you're prohibited from doing it again with the same question for a certain period of time.
Yeah. So, those are more sensible rules. I think even better than what Maine does is to say that you can only use a ballot initiative to take something out of the statutes. So if you're going to repeal a paragraph, section, or chapter of the statutes, you can do that. and that I wouldn't use it to veto legislative decisions, because of course they could veto good legislative decisions. But you know, if you just use it for purely deregulatory purposes.
I made a joke once that we should pass a constitutional amendment. And I was completely joking, and then somebody thought it was a great idea, where we say the first year of the House session is when they business as usual, but in the second year of a House session, they can do nothing but repeal.
Yeah.
Like,
Michael Humer has suggested something like that as a serious proposal. So,
well, didn't he suggest a whole second Congress?
Yes, he did.
That just repeal stuff. And I'd sign up for that one in a heartbeat. I'd run for that. That's an office I'd love to run for. Repeal that. What, in general, all of it? Right. What happens? Like, we do have some crazy bills on the way this year, and people are, the free staters are getting really creative with how they're approaching bills that have been hung up in the legislature. And you're more of a policy and an academic person who understands this a heck of a lot better than I do. What are your opinions on people doing things like attaching a rider to the budget that says you don't need a front license plate?
Yeah. I see a strong political science sort of rationale for doing some things in the budget that the caucus wants, but they may not want to be individually on the record as having voted for that specific thing. And so leadership does this, and membership goes along with it because they actually want this. And so I don't see anything intrinsically wrong with doing policy through the budget. And of course, Democrats are making an issue of this now, but Democrats have used it as well. And a lot of good policy has been put through that way. Sometimes the way democracy works is through representative accountability, right? We elect representatives, the representatives elect their leadership, and then leadership takes the ball and runs with it. And if you don't like what leadership is doing, replace the leadership. You know, that is your answer. But having, endless sort of process input from ordinary rank and file members is maybe not always the best way to make policy.
Well, I mean, we've seen complaints the other way. I think it was Thomas Massey who had posted a chart on Twitter showing the number of floor amendments that had been heard on the House floor year over year, and how it's been declining in the past 40 years from thousands of floor amendments heard to in the past 2 years, not a single floor amendment has been heard in the House of Representatives, where people aren't actually being allowed to do their job. It's all omnibus motions that are written in backroom deals. And everyone's like, you either vote yes or no. You don't get to amend anything. You don't get a say on this.
Yeah, I think it can go too far. And I think it's actually kind of stupid for leadership to do that, because you can get floor amendments that actually improve a bill and bring new ideas to the fore that you might not have thought about. So I think the U.S. House has gone too far toward centralizing power and leadership, but I think there's definitely a role for it. I think you end up with worse policymaking if you just if you make it a sort of free for all.
And well, on the topic of pending legislation, the million-dollar question, what are your opinions as a political scientist and as the founder of the Free State Project about the constitutional amendment to declare independence for New Hampshire?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've long been on record as supporting a right to secede. I think it's clearly constitutionally permissible and morally permissible in general for states to secede if they want to. My personal opinion is that I don't think New Hampshire needs its own army and diplomatic corps. I think we can achieve a free society without declaring complete independence. So I'd probably be a no vote actually when it came to vote on that. But it'd be interesting to have the exercise, and I'm glad that there's a sort of credible threat, because you can't hold the federal government accountable and you can't maintain federalism if you don't have access to the ultimate sanction, which is independence.
I go back to it, and I just think that because the idea was first started getting floating around in circles by Alu Axelman and the NH Independence Institute, like for the past few years. And I was like, oh, it's a pipe dream. They're just trying to educate people on like how bad the federal government is. It'll never happen. And then this constitutional amendment gets them in, and somebody asked me, he's like, what do you think its chances are? I'm like, 2 years ago, I just said it's a joke. Now I'm not sure. Like, I'm not sure. This might pass the House. I don't think it passes the Senate, but like, people are angry enough that it might pass the House.
I mean, doesn't a constitutional amendment in New Hampshire have to get a 2/3 majority in each chamber?
Right. But we've even seen Democrats come out in support of it.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. Even Democratic celebrities like Sarah Silverman made a video about how she was in support of it.
Yeah.
And for all wildly different reasons too. Like some of the Democrats want to secede because they don't want to be part of a country where vaccines aren't mandated. But like, it's all wildly different reasons to support secession. But like, it's crazy that like, I can't just outright dismiss its chances of passing anymore.
Yeah, no, I think it's good to have the conversation, you know, and a GMU law professor, Frank Buckley, wrote a book just, I think, last year or maybe even this year called American Secession. And I reviewed it for it's either the American Conservative or Modern Age. And one of the points I made in the review, it's an interesting book. He kind of goes on both sides. He wants to take secession seriously, but he also is not sure he supports it. And he makes the case that it's constitutional. But my take on it is that, you know, secession could happen gradually just because the federal government sort of loses the power to actually enforce its laws. I mean, we've seen that happen with marijuana, right? The federal government does not have the resources to enforce marijuana prohibition in states that have legalized it. Well, what happens if they then lose the authority to enforce, you know, cryptocurrency regulations or, you know, all sorts of other things that they're trying to regulate? You know, they depend on cooperation of state and local authorities. And so you could actually get little by little states getting effective sort of de facto independence just because they're not cooperating.
And I mean, so you're saying the 10th Amendment's the better route to secession, which, hey, maybe if the 10th Amendment leads to just a collapse of the federal government to something that is sustainably just manages foreign affairs for the independent states, I think people would call that a win. Even the secessionists might call that a win.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's not just that the 10th Amendment is doing this. I think it's the fact that the federal government is dysfunctional.
Right.
And
my biggest defense against 9/11 conspiracies is like, I don't think the government is competent enough to have pulled it off.
No. And it's losing just the capacity even to sustain itself. I mean, look at the problems with the IRS. I haven't checked recently, but for 6 months they had not processed my tax return. So I don't know if they have. But I know that there are millions of tax returns that were due back in May that the IRS still has not processed. You know,
that's what you get for the lifeblood of the government. Yeah, that's what you get for paying taxes. I have my own moral obligations, my moral oppositions to that, and my own opinions on that, but that's what you get for paying taxes.
I suppose so.
This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming on tonight, Jason. Where can people follow you and learn more about what you're doing and look at more of your work?
I'm easily Googleable, Jason Sorens. You can find me on Twitter. Also, that's my handle, Jason Sorens. And check out, of course, FSP.org and freedominthe50states.org for the index. That's freedominthe50states.org.
Get that up. So you guys, again, freedominthe50states.org. Check the description of the podcast or video you're watching or listening to for all those links, and make sure you give Jason a follow. Make sure you hit that like button, hit that subscribe button, leave some comments, let me know what you thought and any questions you might have moving forward in the future for other shows or other guests that we're going to have. And until next time, again, Jason, thank you so much for joining. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in live. And thank you, everyone, for listening after the fact. But until next time, stay free. Thanks again for tuning in and joining us tonight. Make sure you hit that like button and leave a comment below to let us know your thoughts. If you haven't subscribed, go ahead and hit that big red subscribe button on YouTube and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live. If you enjoyed this content, you can join our production team on Patreon by following the link in the description. And don't forget to follow on social media and join our community Discord channel by following the links in the description as well. The best part of all of this is the community that we're building and growing. So go ahead and join us. And thanks once again to our awesome sponsors and patrons for making all of this possible. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts. So until next time, everybody, be free.